Imagine trying to build a city's future. Maybe like putting up new houses or businesses, but the rule book you have to use is decades old. It's kind of like trying to navigate with a really, really old map, right? What happens when those foundational rules just don't fit anymore or they're just too complicated? Today, we're going to dig into exactly that situation. We're looking at a specific document, a professional services agreement between the city of Shawnee, Oklahoma, and a firm called Fries & Nichols, Inc., FNI for short. Our mission here is to explore how a city actually goes about, you know, completely modernizing its land development rules by creating something called a Unified Development Code, or UDC.
Yeah, and what's really striking when you look at this agreement is the scale of it. It's a big deal. We're not just talking about tweaking a few sentences here and there. It's a fundamental rethink of how Shawnee wants to grow. And there's a significant price tag attached. The agreement mentions a lump sum fee of $344,492. That kind of money tells you this is a serious multi-stage effort aimed at shaping the city for years to come.
$344,000. That is definitely a serious investment. So, okay, let's start with the basics. Why does Shawnee even need this unified development code? This didn't just come out of the blue, I assume.
No, not at all. It's very much connected to their bigger picture planning. Back in October 2019, Shawnee adopted a new comprehensive plan. They called it Shawnee Next Horizons. Hmm. And that plan really laid out the community's vision, you know, where they see themselves going in terms of growth and development over the next couple of decades.
Right. And that's the crux of it, isn't it? You have this ambitious, forward-looking vision, but then you look at the tools you have to implement it. Their existing regulations for land development were, well, pretty old and all over the place.
Yeah.
You mentioned subdivision rules from 1990.
Yeah, 1990. And sign regulations from 1999, the zoning code itself was a bit more recent, 2014, but still separate.
So you've got these pieces from different times, likely not always fitting together perfectly.
Exactly. That's the core problem they needed to solve. How do you make that modern Shawnee Next Horizons vision a reality when your rule book is, frankly, outdated and disjointed? These different documents, plus probably other related policies and ordinances, they all needed a thorough review. They needed modernization. And, crucially, they needed to be integrated, pulled together.
And the things that that's what here is pretty significant, I imagine. If your rules don't match your plan.
Well, you risk stagnation, right? You might discourage the very kind of development you want, or you make it so complex and confusing that businesses and developers just go elsewhere because the rules are unclear or contradictory.
It really becomes about guiding the city's physical shape, its character, even its economic future.
Precisely. Aligning regulations with the comprehensive plan is fundamental to achieving that shared vision.
Okay, so we understand the why. Let's move to the what. What exactly is this Unified Development Code, this UDC, supposed to look like when it's finished?
Think of it as the central rule book, a single point of reference for everything related to land development. It takes their existing zoning code from 2014, the sign regulations from 2002, actually, and those subdivision regulations from 1990, and consolidates them. Essentially, Chapter 22 of their current city code gets reshaped and updated into this new UDC.
So it's a consolidation, but also sounds like a serious cleanup and modernization effort. I noticed the agreement mentions they even have to figure out what to do with some existing parts of Chapter 22 that might not fit neatly into a standard UDC. Things like articles about a Citizens Advisory Committee on sustainability or the comprehensive plan itself or even arts and public places.
Yeah.
What does that tell you?
It tells you they're being thorough, which is good. They're looking at the whole picture. It shows the UDC isn't just about setbacks and building heights, you know. It touches on how the city operates, what it values, its overall character. But the UDC isn't the only piece here. There's a companion document mentioned, the Engineering Design Criteria Manual, or EDC.
Ah, the EDC. So oh, yeah. What's its role?
The EDC is typically where you find all the technical stuff.
Yeah.
The detailed specifications, design guidance for infrastructure, roads, sewers, water lines, that sort of thing. And interestingly, the agreement notes that city staff had already started drafting an EDC.
Oh, okay. So they weren't starting from absolute scratch there.
Right. So FNI's job regarding the EDC involves reviewing that existing draft, providing a technical memo with recommendations, and then helping finalize it, maybe developing some standard specifications or construction details.
That makes sense. Like the UDC sets the general rules, what you can build and where, and the EDC provides the technical how-to for the infrastructure supporting it. And referencing the EDC within the UDC probably gives the city flexibility too, right? Mm. They can update technical standards in the EDC as technology or best practices change, without having to constantly amend the main UDC ordinance.
Exactly. It builds in that adaptability, which is really important. Things change fast in engineering and construction.
Okay, so we have the why, aligning old rules with a new vision, and the what, the UDC and its companion EDC. Now let's get into the how. This wasn't a quick job. The agreement outlines a pretty structured journey, broken down into five phases for creating the UDC and EDC. Let's walk through phase one.
Phase one is titled Code Diagnostic and Analysis Report, and that title sums it up pretty well. The main goal here is to lay the groundwork, identify all the issues with the current codes by talking to everyone who uses them, developers, staff, residents, stakeholders, then discuss possible solutions and, really importantly, build consensus on the best path forward.
That consensus part sounds key,
especially
since the agreement highlights a major decision in this phase, figuring out the best zoning approach. Should it be traditional zoning or maybe form-based codes, which focus more on the building's form in relationship to the street, or maybe some kind of hybrid?
That's a fundamental choice. And the goal, it says, is to find an approach that implements the comprehensive plan's vision, but also keeps the regulations as straightforward as possible for both applicants and the city staff who have to administer them.
That sounds like a balancing act.
Yeah.
Have you seen projects where this initial phase, just getting everyone aligned, is actually the toughest part? Maybe even harder than writing the code itself.
Oh, absolutely. Phase one can be incredibly challenging because you're dealing with diverse perspectives, sometimes conflicting priorities. Getting buy-in early is critical. That's why public engagement is such a big part of this phase.
Right, I saw that. They planned quite a bit of outreach.
Yeah, F&I was tasked with setting up a dedicated project website that serves as a hub for information, draft documents, educational materials, even ways for people to participate virtually. It's meant to be transparent with contact info and a way for the public to submit comments or ask questions.
That's essential for building trust. And it wasn't just a website, was it? There were interviews too.
Yes, a series of virtual interviews planned over 2 days with a really wide range of stakeholders. We're talking planning commission, city commission, zoning board, key city departments like community development and public works, Shawnee Forward, which is likely their economic development group, emergency services, but also external groups like the Home Builders Association, realtors, even the banking community.
Wow, that's casting a wide net to capture different viewpoints.
Definitely. And on top of the targeted interviews, they also planned a community open house, aiming for both in-person and virtual options to maximize participation.
So lots of input gathering. What were the concrete outputs of phase one?
The main deliverables were that project website and the final code diagnostic and analysis report provided digitally. And the process involved several key meetings. The project kickoff, although stakeholder interviews, the open house, time for staff to review the draft report, and then presentations to the Planning Commission, and potentially support for a City Commission meeting.
Okay, so phase one is the deep dive assessment, setting the direction and making sure people are on board. Once that diagnostic report is done, and they've hopefully agreed on a zoning approach, what happens next? Phase two must be where the writing really begins.
Precisely. Phase two is draft UDC. This is where F&I takes the findings and recommendations from the diagnostic report and starts translating them into actual code language. They're developing the specific zoning districts, the lists of permitted uses, the development standards, the procedures for applications and reviews, all the nuts and bolts.
And the agreement mentions some key areas they might address.
Yeah, it highlights things like using illustrations to make the code easier to understand, building in flexibility for creative or innovative development projects, looking at new approaches to subdivision and lot design, streamlining procedures.
So not just new rules, but making the rules work better.
Right. Also updating definitions, reorganizing the whole thing for better readability, considering different housing types to promote choice and affordability, updating parking requirements, which is always a big one, and modernizing the sign regulations based on current best practices.
That's a massive amount of detailed work. How do they structure that drafting process?
They plan to tackle it in chunks, which makes sense. The agreement lists sections like general provisions, subdivision regulations, design standards, zoning part one, zoning part two, and signs. For each chunk, F&I would prepare a draft, give city staff about 2 to 4 weeks to review it, and then they'd meet virtually to discuss the feedback and work through any issues.
Iterative refinement, section by section. Makes sense. And the deliverable for phase two is?
The deliverable is the complete draft unified development code, again, in digital format. And the process included about 6 virtual meetings to review those draft sections with staff, plus 1 final virtual meeting for a comprehensive review of the whole draft.
Okay, so after all that drafting and internal review, we get to phase three. UDC refinement, and adoption. This sounds like taking the draft code public.
Exactly. This phase is about guiding the draft UDC through the formal adoption process required by the city and state law. A key step mentioned is F&I presenting the final draft at a joint workshop for both the Planning Commission and the City Commission.
Ah, getting both bodies in the same room to see the final product before the official hearings. Smart. Reduces surprises.
Yeah, it gives them a chance to get an overview, ask questions, and discuss it before it goes on to the public hearing agendas. After that workshop, F&I would then participate in one Planning Commission public hearing and then one City Commission public hearing to answer questions and support the UDC's adoption.
And the final output of this phase is the big one.
The final adopted Unified Development Code. Hopefully adopted.
Right. Okay, so the UDC is adopted. But we'll have that companion document, the EDC. Uh-huh. That's phase four.
Correct. Phase four is engineering design criteria and standard specifications. Remember, city staff had already started a draft EDC. So here, F&I's role involves reviewing the city's existing subdivision regulations again, alongside that draft EDC prepared by staff.
And then they refine it. How does that work?
F&I first develops a technical memo. This outlines their recommended changes or considerations for completing the EDC and any needed standard specifications. Then, based on that memo and feedback, they develop the complete draft EDC document. City staff reviews it, F&I refines it based on their comments, and develops any necessary standard specifications, drawing on best practices and staff guidance.
Sounds like a collaborative process with city engineering staff.
Very much so. It includes staff interviews and three specific staff review meetings built into the process. The deliverables for phase four are that initial technical memo, the draft EDC, and then the final EDC and standard specifications.
That seems incredibly thorough. And there's one more phase. Phase five, optional services. What's that about?
Phase five is essentially for potential future support, if the city decides they need it and authorizes it. F&I could create a user-friendly development manual. This would be a guide to help both city staff and the public developers, homeowners, navigate the new UDC. It might include things like flowcharts, showing the review process, updated application forms, step instructions, maybe policies on public notification or meeting procedures.
Ah, so it's about making the new code easier to actually use in practice.
Yeah.
Demystifying it.
Exactly. Making it as user-friendly as possible after investing so much in creating it.
Okay, so this whole massive project, this transformation of Shawnee's development rules, it all stems from this one professional services agreement. It really lays out the roadmap. Let's maybe pivot slightly and talk about the agreement itself, the terms, the responsibilities. For a project this big and long, the contract details must be critical, right?
Oh, absolutely critical. These agreements try to anticipate issues and set expectations. Understanding them is key for both the city and the consultant.
So what are some of the key contractual elements we see here? Let's start with, say, the timeline and flexibility.
Okay. The agreement states F&I is authorized to start work upon signing and aims to complete everything within 24 months from the kickoff meeting. That's the target. But importantly, it also acknowledges that delays can happen. If the project gets held up for more than 60 days for reasons outside F&I's control, the agreement allows for adjustments to the schedule and, potentially, the compensation.
That protects the consultant if the city causes delays. Makes sense.
Right. And on the flip side, the city can order changes to the scope of work. If they do, the contract says an equitable adjustment will be made by mutual agreement. So there's built-in adaptability.
Which you definitely need on a complex multi-year project like this. Things always come up. Now, what about the money side? The financial realities beyond that initial lump sum?
Good question. While the core services we've discussed fall under that $344,492 lump sum, the agreement specifies that any additional services work that goes beyond that defined scope would be billed hourly. And there's a detailed schedule of charges attached, showing different hourly rates for various levels of professionals, from senior staff down to CAT technicians.
So extra work costs extra, based on who does it.
Exactly. And there's another interesting detail, multipliers for certain direct expenses. For example, things like travel might be billed at cost plus a 15% markup, a 1.15 multiplier, or if they use non-F&I personnel for certain tasks, that might be billed at 2.0 times the cost.
Ah, so the total cost could end up being higher than the lump sum if the scope expands or there are significant expenses. Understanding those multipliers is important for the city's budgeting.
Definitely. It highlights the potential total cost of ownership on just the main fee. You need to factor in those supporting costs.
And the city, Shawnee, they have responsibilities too, right? The agreement calls them the owner or client. What do they need to do to keep things moving?
Yes, the client's role is vital. The agreement outlines several key responsibilities for the city. Things like providing suitable meeting spaces and handling the logistics, contacting the people who need to be invited to meetings, and this is a big one, promptly reviewing all the documents F&I submits and providing clear, consolidated feedback.
No trickling in comments one by one from different departments.
Ideally, no. Consolidated feedback saves a lot of time and potential confusion. The city also had to designate specific people. A project representative with authority on project matters, Seth Barkheimer, and an accounting representative, Jacob Bussell. And they need to help arrange access to property if F&I needs it for site visits or analysis.
So it really is a partnership. The consultant can't do it alone.
Not effectively, no. Timely client input and decisions are crucial.
Okay, let's touch on the less exciting but really important stuff. Risk and liability. What kind of clauses protect the consultant, and what risks does the city retain?
This is where the fine print really matters. For instance, there's a clause limiting F&I's liability. It states they aren't liable for indirect, incidental, or consequential damages.
Meaning what, exactly?
Things like lost profits or loss of use that might indirectly result from the project or their work. It limits their exposure to broader business impacts. Another key point, F&I isn't liable for problems that arise because they relied on information the city provided. If the city gives them faulty data or inaccurate base maps, for example,
then issues resulting from that are the city's responsibility.
Essentially, yes. The agreement says the client indemnifies F&I against claims arising from that reliance. So the accuracy of city-provided information is critical.
That puts the onus on the city to ensure their data is good. What about the documents created, the UDC, the EDC, all the reports? Who owns them?
The client, the city, owns the documents once they've paid for them in full. However, there's a caveat. The documents are intended for this specific project. The agreement states the client shouldn't reuse them for other projects or let others reuse them without getting F&I's written verification or agreement first. If they do reuse them without that, it's entirely at the client's own risk.
So they can't just take the Shawnee UDC and apply it somewhere else without checking back with F&I?
Correct. It protects the consultant from having their work used inappropriately or out of context. Interestingly, F&I is allowed to reuse general information, concepts, or techniques from the project for their other work, but at their own risk.
Okay. And one last area under risk. What about guarantees? Does F&I guarantee the outcomes?
No. And this is standard in consulting agreements. The contract explicitly states there are no guarantees. For example, if F&I provides opinions of probable construction costs related to the new standards, they don't guarantee those costs will be accurate. Market conditions, labor costs, those things fluctuate beyond their control. Similarly, if they were involved in observing construction later, the agreement clarifies they observe progress but don't guarantee the contractor's performance or supervise their actual work methods.
So the ultimate responsibility for costs and contractor performance still rests with the city and the contractors themselves.
That's generally the case. The consultant provides expertise and guidance, but the city retains the ultimate project risk and oversight responsibility. They need their own robust processes.
Wow. Okay, so stepping back, we've really unpacked how this one document, this professional services agreement, serves as the blueprint for a potentially transformative project for Shawnee. It's not just a dry contract. It's the instruction manual for reshaping how the city grows and develops for years, maybe decades. It's a huge, complex, iterative process.
It really is. And it underscores something important about our cities, doesn't it? There's this hidden layer of complexity, these foundational documents and processes that shapes everything we see around us, the buildings, the streets, the whole feel of a place. A unified development code like this isn't just a bunch of legal jargon. It's really a living document, or it should be. It reflects what a community wants to be, what it aspires to, balanced with practical needs. And it's constantly being interpreted and applied, shaping urban life every day.
That's a great point. It makes you think, you know, the next time you walk down a street or see a new development going up, there's this whole intricate framework beneath the surface guiding it all. It's the result of countless hours of work, debate, and collaboration, all trying to turn a community's vision into reality on the ground.